From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
Governor Brown started off 2012 by saying, quote, "I'm going directly to the voters because I don't want to get bogged down in partisan gridlock," unquote. He did, and voters passed the first broad-scale tax increase in memory. In addition, the state's economic recovery and prior budget cuts combined to bring a possible end to a decade of acute state budget challenges. What were the major accomplishments at the state capitol in 2012? What were the important takeaways from the 2012 election? And what is likely to be on the political agenda for the governor and the legislature in 2013? We'll take a look back at the year that was and take a look forward at the likely political battles in 2013 with John Myers, political editor for News 10 in Sacramento, and Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee.
We'll also hear from Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Professor Nathan Monroe from UC Merced, and get their take on how what happened in Sacramento in 2012 impacted the region and what to look for in 2013.
2012, a year in review, and the agenda for 2013.
From Fresno, the Matty Report, with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. It's often been said that California is ungovernable. Some, however, see a light at the end of the tunnel. The question is it the end of the tunnel, or is it another train coming in our direction? We're fortunate to have two of the most knowledgeable and highly regarded journalists covering state politics with us today, Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee and John Myers, political editor for News 10 in Sacramento. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thanks.
Well, the state budget is always Exhibit A when people talk about dysfunction at the state capitol.
Always.
But there's good news, apparently, from the LAO. He's saying it looks like we're only going to be $2 billion in the hole next year. He calls it a dramatic turnaround, quote unquote. So we out of the woods?
Don't you love that when only $2 billion becomes the rosy the thing of it all? I mean, things are better. I mean, I'll let Dan talk too.
Compared to 15 or 20
yeah,
billion.
Yeah, totally. I mean, things are better. You have to give credit where credit is due. There have been some better budget actions than there were in the previous few years. That's not to say they were perfect, but they were better. The economy has done a little bit better. I mean, there have been some things that have gone the right direction, but do you call it out of the hole? I think Mr. Walters will probably say no, but I think there's you know, ways to go.
What say you, Mr. Walters?
Well, the biggest thing, of course, is the passage of Proposition 30, the governor's tax plan, and that gives him $6 or $7 billion a year, and that covers part of the hole. No, I don't think we're out of the hole, because I think, for one thing, a lot of the spending cuts, so-called, have been basically, if not temporary legally, they're temporary politically. There's the sort of things, welfare cuts, health services cuts, that the Democrats and the legislature hated to do and would restore in a nanosecond if they got a chance, number one. Number two, the underlying economy is still struggling. We still have 2 million unemployed in the state and double-digit unemployment. So that's not going to, and that's not coming back real fast. The third thing is that these taxes are temporary, and they're going to expire sometime. Now, they may be renewed or not. But
as he leaves office.
As Jerry Brown leaves office, the last of those temporary taxes expire. The other part of Proposition 30, by the way, locks into the Constitution $5 billion worth of spending on realignment that will go on even when those taxes expire. So we've locked down the spending side of the ledger even more, and we are financing it with temporary taxes in an uncertain economy. So while they may, the situation may have gotten better right now, over the long term, you still have a structural deficit in California's finances, then, and it's probably going to go on for a while.
I think one thing, just really quickly, that Dan said is important is that the Prop 30 money is a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid, and that doesn't mean we've figured out how to fix the patient. We've just found a way to not kill
the patient. Bleeding, I guess.
Right. Well, you also mentioned realignment. So how's that working? Realignment is where they're moving non-serious, non-violent criminals into county jails as opposed to state prisons. How's that working for the state? How's that working for the county?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you look at what I think all the data so far is anecdotal. I think it's going to take a while to fully figure out exactly the transition, because it's not just obviously public safety, as we've said. It's these other programs, the management of them, and it's part of this very long historical discussion between local and state government about who controls what and who pays for what. Certainly, the locals are very happy about the part that Dan raised a warning flag about, which is that they know they're going to get the money. I mean, that was their first and foremost concern, is that somehow legislators in Sacramento would pull that money back. I think you've heard mostly good things about the realignment so far, but there are cases, individual cases, where, you know, you've got a big burden in county jails that you didn't have in prisons. I think really it takes time to shake that out.
Yeah, it does take time, and the impact on locals has not been fully felt yet. And also, they've hit a plateau in reducing the prison population under federal court order. And to get that thing down further, they're going to have to direct more serious, if not violent, criminals into the local jails, many of which are not really capable of holding prisoners for long periods of time. They're really not designed for that. And you're having to turn loose lower-level inmates that would otherwise be in county jail. And some of the counties are finding out that this thing is costlier than the money they're getting from the state. And so this thing is still a very much a work in progress.
And I will say that I think one of the things that hasn't been talked about much is when you take the less serious people out of state prisons, you're left with the worst of the worst in state prisons. And you may see more problems, violence, things there. But
I want to fit in a few things as usual. What about redevelopment? Is it saving as much as the governor had hoped? And is it as bad or as bad as the cities were talking about?
One of the reasons why they have a $2 billion deficit in the current fiscal year remaining, even despite the tax increase, is that the redevelopment money has not come in the way they budgeted. Some other things haven't come in the way they budgeted, but the redevelopment money is one. The locals are trying to hold on to as much money as that possible, and there are pitched battles going on all around the state between the State Department of Finance's bean counters and local officials over what is money that the state can seize and what isn't money that the state can't seize. And that's going to go on for a long time. It's not going to be this huge windfall that the budget assumes. It's going to be some money, and maybe more later on, but it's not going to be this windfall that the budget assumes.
Well, let's talk about another small issue, pension reform. Was enough done in 2012 on pension reform to take that off the front burner?
Small issue is probably the operative phrase here. This was just enough pension reform so that they can say they did pension reform, because they felt it would be a downer on the Proposition 30 if they didn't do it. But it's another one work in progress. Look, the big pension problem in the state is not the state government. It's not even county governments. The big problem in the state is city governments, because they have their huge percentage of their budgets go to personnel, and their high cost personnel, police and firemen, with high pensions. And they're the ones. That's why Stockton's in bankruptcy. That's why San Bernardino's in bankruptcy, and why several other cities are flirting with insolvency, because these things are really biting them to pay for the benefits that were increased, number one, and to pay for the losses in the pension investment funds, number two.
Okay, one sentence. What was the biggest legislative accomplishment in 2012? Assuming the governor's big accomplishment was Prop 30.
I think the legislative accomplishment was Prop 30. I think everything that happened at the Capitol was with an eye to that election. Pensions, legislative proposals, everything was trying to package that measure.
What do you think, Dan?
I think the big story of 2012 in the legislature may not be something they did in the legislature, but the fact that the Democrats won supermajorities in both houses of the legislature in the November elections. And that will be a story that will play out now over the next few years is, okay, they got it. They've been talking about it for years. We finally got it. What are they going to do with it, if anything?
We're talking with John Myers and Dan Walters about the November election. What about those election reforms? What impact did the top two primary and redistricting have on the outcome?
They actually had a lot of impact, I think, this year. They created a lot more competitive districts. That was the redistricting part. And number two, the top two, it's not a perfect thing. Both of those things were supposed to result in a more kind of collegial and moderate sort of legislature and less polarization. And I think we'll have kind of that effect. In fact, it's kind of ironic that the Democrats get their two-thirds supermajorities, but there are enough moderate Democrats. The only way they can get that is to win some swing districts with moderate Democrats who are not going to be interested in doing all the things that the liberals want them to do.
Well, let me point out two things, I think. One is that those changes meant more money in this campaign, and that's something that people tend to forget. They don't like money in politics, but when you make it more competitive and things that are more upheaval, you're going to spend more on politics. The second is the one that wasn't mentioned. Top two and redistricting are important, but the other one was the term limits. I mean, whether that had an impact on the election versus what's going to happen at the legislature, you can serve 12 years now if you can win re-election. You're going to have, I think, a different kind of legislator when you put all that together. Now, is it enough different?
Now,
remains to be seen.
For our viewers, the previous rule was was?
6 years in the Assembly, 8 years in the Senate. Now it's 12 years.
But you could combine those.
You could combine them. But what happened, of course, is you had people playing musical chairs, jumping from one house to the other. Now you can serve 12 years in one house if you can win re-election. And in the few freshman legislators that I've talked to so far coming in, several of them have mentioned that idea that now I can see this person potentially for years to come that I can find a way to work with.
And you'll see that in the leadership changes. When the current batch of leaders leave and the newcomers come in, they'll be able to remain in those leadership positions for a long time. You could have a Speaker of the Assembly for a decade now, or a pro tem of the Senate for 8 years or something like that.
Yep. Okay, well, what about the influence of outside money, John? How big an influence this?
Well, there was a lot of it. I mean, whether it changed the actual election results or whether it just changed the narrative, I think remains to be seen. I mean, certainly the largest amount of that money was this, that got a lot of attention, was this money out from outside of the state, Arizona. Actually, it wasn't even from Arizona. It was laundered through a couple of different committees.
From,
right,
really.
Exactly. That was to play in the no on Prop 30, yes on Prop 32 campaign. And that became part of this narrative about where money is. I mean, the reality is you can't get money out of politics. I mean, it's always fascinating that people want to get it out of it. You're not going to get money out of it. The question is, do you know where the money's coming from and what influence and what do the voters know about that money and what do they make of it?
Well, Dan, what about the minorities and ethnic groups? What about their influence on the election? Was this a watershed election in that respect?
I don't think it was to the extent you saw another surge of Latino voting and another surge of Latino legislators and some even a Republican or two, as a matter of fact. And you saw that, and I think it, and part of that was that the redistricting commission, when it created the new batch of legislative and congressional seats, was very sensitive to the idea of maximizing the chances for Latinos and blacks to be elected to the legislature, and it succeeded. It did succeed. In effect, it was a kind of a gerrymander. It was an ethnic gerrymander as opposed to a partisan gerrymander, but there was that thing, if they did the proceedings, and that had that effect. So you're going to see more Latinos, not more blacks, just they're trying to just hold on to what they got, but more Latinos in the legislature, and that will have an impact the time goes. Remember, the Latino population of California will become the largest single ethnic group probably in two or three more years in California. And this was a kind of a coming of age. Their voting by Latinos has been low historically. It jumped up a lot this year. And I think you're seeing really the dawn of a new... In fact, you're seeing a post-racial era in very heavily Latino areas such as Los Angeles, in which Latinos now are dividing into factions themselves and creating essentially pseudo-parties for all intents and purposes.
I wanted to ask about online registration, John. Yeah. Was that a key in any of the initiatives or elections?
I think it was fascinating. I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of people who used a service in a very small amount of time, I mean, by registering. And we don't really know all of who the electorate is yet. We haven't got all the final tallies. We have to, all of the politicos get to sift through it. But what's fascinating is that you have to think that people who registered in that system were much more active than they would have been otherwise. And I go back to who the electorate is, as Dan's been talking about. I mean, we've always talked about that California has this kind of an exclusive electorate, more white, more conservative than the state as a whole. Online registration probably brought in some younger voters who have a little more liberal passion, and I think if you're Jerry Brown, you've got to be pleased with who turned out at the elections for his Prop 30.
Yeah, I heard a lot of younger voters came online.
The exit polling, and that's the only way we can gauge such things, Exit polling is not a perfect science, and I think they probably went overboard in a couple of cases, but clearly this was a younger and more diverse election, particularly more generational than anything else. I mean, half of California's voters have been over 50 years old in recent elections, and close to three quarters of them have been white. In this election, the white vote was down in maybe the 60% range, and it was definitely younger. There was a fewer voters proportionately were in the over 50 category.
Well, let me ask one last question in the segment, and that is the supermajority that Democrats have now in both houses. Besides that, what is the takeaway from the November election?
I think it was a Democratic sweep in California. There's no way to define it. The Democrats won the whole Magila. They got more seats in the legislature, more seats in Congress. They passed the ballot measures they wanted to pass. They basically defeated the ballot measures they wanted to defeat. So it was a big power move by the Democrats and their allied groups, the labor unions, whatnot, and a very successful
one. And certainly, the question is whether it was all because the Democrats did a great job or because they had no one opposed to them. The Republican Party's shrinking in California, I think, is another takeaway, too.
So what is the governor and the legislature's agenda for 2013? We're talking with John Myers, political editor from News 10 in Sacramento, and Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. So, Dan, what about education? The governor's talking about changing funding for schools, increasing teacher accountability, et cetera. What's the education agenda for 2013?
The big fight in education in 2013 will be over what the governor calls a weighted formula. Now that they have a little more money in the school system to play with, thanks to Proposition 30, he wants to give more of that money to schools that have low-performing students. That's going to be mostly minority students, what we used to call minority students, and relatively less of that money to the wealthier school districts that are doing well. Well, that's not going to sit too well with a lot of folks because it gets away from the whole idea of equalization that's been a mantra here for decades. But the education authorities say if you really want to do something about education, you've got to bring up the performance of Black and Latino youngsters. And the only way you can do that is to put more effort into the better teachers, more money, more individualized attention. And he wants to do that. But it's going to be a battle. It certainly is.
Okay. What about water, John? There's an $11 billion water bond that's been in front of the legislature. I think they pulled it twice.
Moved, yes.
Keep moving it. Is something going to happen on water in 2013?
Well, I mean, the governor, you know, gave us a sense that that was going to be on his agenda last year. I mean, we've looked here at his push on the tunnels, on the dual tunnels that would go around the delta, the peripheral tunnels now instead of the peripheral canal. Yeah, exactly. That's not terribly popular with a number of groups. That's a heavy lift, I think, unto itself. The governor and Democrats in the Capitol have talked about downsizing that water bond. Of course, the problem is when you crack open a political deal on something like a water bond, which, you know, it's everybody had a little something in it, then you have to renegotiate the entire thing. They've got until 2014 if they're going to put that on the ballot, so they've got some time. But, you know, the question is how many different things can Jerry Brown and the Democrats in the legislature focus on? Can you walk and chew gum at the same time?
Well, that water bond would not finance those tunnels, but it finances all the kind of the lubrication parts of that project, the parts that make that tunnel politically palatable to people, restoration of the delta and everything. And it has right now kind of a lot of pork in it, and it's probably going to have to come out.
Well, let's talk about another big project, that is high-speed rail. They're about $55 billion short. The governor says there's lots to do. Does that mean more financing in 2013?
Well, as Edward Dirksen said, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon it adds up to real money. In this case, it is real money, $55 billion. Look, they're probably going to build that piece down in the valley from Chowchilla to Delano or someplace. And whether it turns out to be a train of nowhere or truly the beginning of a statewide system is very much up in the air. The state doesn't have the money. It's going to have to get the money from the federal government and private investors. And I suspect 10, 15 years from now, we're going to still be asking whether they're going to get the money to build high-speed rail in California.
Well, and just ask Kevin McCarthy, the number three ranking Republican in the House from Bakersfield, who says no way, no how. I mean, that's right. Washington is California.
They're counting on federal money. And
you can't do it without it.
Right. Yeah. But what about business regulatory reform? Are we going to see stuff in that area, perhaps a reform of CEQA?
I think we will see an effort to change CEQA somewhat. There's great reluctance among the environmental groups to do that, but there seems to be a little head of steam developing with the governor and some of the legislative leaders because they want to get away from the idea that Democrats are hostile to business. And the governor owes business, as a matter of fact, for indirectly helping him pass Proposition 30. So there is some steam behind that.
I do think that is the great test of the two-thirds power in the legislature, though, because Democrats aren't monolithic in the Capitol. Some are more environmental, some are more business moderate, and that's going to be a fight that environmentalists are going to. That's going to show the factions of Democrats.
And it also might be an area where the Republicans can come back into play because since the Democrats are split on that issue, which I think they are. Then the Republicans could combine with some Democrats to push that through over the objections of the more liberal Democrats.
Okay, let's end with this question. What do you think the big public policy issues are going to be in 2013?
I don't think you go away from the budget, and maybe not so much in filling holes, in trying to determine how you move forward. If the economy is truly recovering, even if it's a slow recovery, what do you fix first? What do you go back and fix that you had to do in the worst times? And that's going to be, you know, the test of Democrats and Brown about what they can do.
Is part of that lowering the threshold for passing local taxes that Leader Steinberg's been talking about?
Maybe, but I think that's a broader political kind of... I think if you just go back to the budget issues, you've got Democrats who say, look, can we restore X, Y, or Z that we had to cut before? And that debate with the governor and with the state and with the money that's coming in, I think, is a big one.
Yeah, all of that money from Proposition 30 is essentially already spoken for. And a lot of it would go to pay, under the governor's own plan, debts that are owed by the state, the so-called wall of debt. And so they've got to... That will be a big decision. Do you pay back the debts, or do you go restore social services and health services that were cut? And that's another thing that kind of divides the Democratic Party.
We're talking with Dan Walters and John Myers. Republicans are now below 30% of registered voters in California. How does the Republican Party make itself relevant again in California?
Isn't that a great question? I think the first thing they've got to do, Mark, is they've got to figure out exactly what they think their problem is. I mean, you talk to Republicans after the election, and the wounds are still a little bit raw. Some of them believe it was messaging. Some of them, you know, some of them say we just didn't get our message out. Some of them say we have to moderate our message. That fight, until they figure that out, I don't know how they resolve their problem here because they don't know who they are.
Someone was saying that Republicans become more relevant if they move to the Central Valley and just locate there.
The Republicans got a problem, but you have to put that in perspective. They've been in worse shape in the past in California. They were down to 23 seats in the assembly in the 70s, for example. Democrats at that time had 57% of the voter registration. Democrats only have a little over 40% now. What's really happened is a decline of the Republicans, and to a certain extent the decline of the Democratic registration, has gone into independent voters. Democrats have been able to get those independent voters and decide close races. If Republicans want to be relevant, they've got to go back and get those independents, and it's happened. They have been proven in the past it can happen. Arnold Schwarzenegger got those independent voters. Steve Poizner got those independent voters. Back in the 90s, Pete Wilson got those independent voters. You can do it, but you can't be a right-wing, anti-immigrant, no abortion, all the things. You can't do that in California today because the society of California is not like that.
It's the social issues.
Well, and the Guardian people, whoever the Knights Templar, I would call them, of the California Republican Party, say no way, no how on those issues, and that's why I say they've got to figure out who they are.
Let me ask you about the role of the Republicans in the state legislature going forward. What's their role?
Oh, their role is to make noise. And on certain occasions, as we've discussed before, when the Democrats are split over things maybe like CEQA reform or how a water bond or something like that, then Republicans come back in and play a role in those circumstances. And that'll be a big test of the Assembly's and the Senate's leadership, is whether they can keep the Democrats together, because as they got bigger, they got to become a more diverse group, and it's more difficult to get them all aboard something you want. And they barely have two-thirds in both houses, so they really can't afford to lose anybody on these things.
Yeah, if they could pick an issue or something, that would be, yeah.
Well, let me ask about the supermajorities in both houses the Democrats have that we're talking about. Do you think that there is, a lot of people are talking about Democratic overreach, but as Dan's mentioned, the Democratic Party is splintered among different groups. What do you think is going to happen with that supermajority? Do you think they're going to overreach?
I don't know. I mean, I think the most fascinating part of this thing, as we have talked about, is the fact that for the first time, we get a spotlight shined on the fact that all Democrats aren't alike. And we do have those discussions about what it means to be a California Democrat, and that's a Republican benefit. You've got the core of the Democratic Party clamoring for big change. Taxes, Prop 13, the Holy Grail, anything else that you can come up with. Single-payer health care. I heard that one at one point.
Prop 13 might be the third rail, not the Holy Grail.
Exactly. and so the question is, how do leadership in the legislature tamp that down? Do they tamp that down? What do they pick as their prime issues? And what does Jerry Brown do as all of this? I mean, now Jerry Brown is the most conservative person in the state capitol with power. Sort of.
Yeah, and I agree with that. In fact, you have to remember, even though the Republicans have a problem with their right wing, the Democrats have a problem with their left wing. And this left wing, as John says, is clamoring for all sorts of things. They want to do away with Prop 13. They want to do this. They want to do that. And the fact is, there's not the votes to do those things.
Right.
And there's not the votes and the money to put back all the social programs that have been cut and all the health programs that have been cut. It's just not going to happen. And they have, by passing Proposition 30, by getting two-thirds majorities, they've raised expectations of their left wing, and now they're going to have to kind of dampen them down.
That's kind of the question. Are the Democrats damned if they do and damned if they don't? If they overreach, voters aren't going to like that. Yet if they don't take bold action, people are going to say, well, then why do we put you in power?
They own it now. Republican, and the Republicans have the luxury of not owning it.
And if you're a Republican and you can make that point, then all the better for you in two years.
If you don't like what's going on in Sacramento, Republicans just say, hey, they own it. It's theirs. Blame them. Don't blame us.
Well, let's end with this. What do you think? Are we going to have a more cooperative or more combative legislature in 2013?
I think you're going to—I don't know how to judge the cooperative-combative spectrum issue. I do think you're going to have a different legislature. I do think you're going to have, with the walks of life, with the largest freshman class in modern history in the assembly, you're going to have a different legislature. I think you're going to have a different dynamic where they relate to each other differently. Does that mean they're going to agree at the end of the day? I don't think it means all of a sudden they're like kumbaya.
But
if you look at the politics of San Francisco, the politics of Los Angeles, which are basically one party communities, you see those parties split into factions, and you're going to see that in the legislature. When you have a one-party state, it always divides into factions. Nature abhors a vacuum and fills it with pseudo-parties.
Okay, well, thank you very much, John Myers and Dan Walters.
Up next, what are the implications for the San Joaquin Valley? We'll talk to Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Professor Nathan Monroe from UC Merced, and get their take on how what happened in Sacramento in 2012 impacted the region and what to look for in 2013.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. 2012 was a busy year in state politics, but what impact did it have on the Valley? And what exactly does the new supermajority of Democrats in both houses of the state legislature mean for the region? We're joined by three observers of Valley politics. They are Bill McEwen, columnist for the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, and Professor Nathan Monroe, director of undergraduate programs of political science at UC Merced. Welcome to all of you. Paul, let's start with you. What about the San Joaquin Valley? What happened in Sacramento that had a big impact here?
I'm not so sure that anything that happened in Sacramento this past year has taken effect yet. A lot of things that we've talked about, realignment, redevelopment, those kind of things, those happen, but the effects really aren't evident. It's funny, a lot of things were happening in the central San Joaquin Valley, in Tulare and Kings counties. A lot of big projects are going on there. Road building, widening of 198, a new campus for COS in Tulare. But those things were already done. How the things like realignment and redistricting play out, probably gonna show up this year rather than next year, 2013 rather than 2012.
What about you, Bill?
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with Paul on that, and the big issue is realignment. We've already seen the impact here in the central San Joaquin Valley, with the local counties saying that they're not getting their share of realignment dollars. And what's interesting is that they have protested to the governor about it, but Governor Brown, being the master of political jujitsu, he actually gave the responsibility of dividing up this money to a county association. So, in other words, the association of all the counties in the state. And what we found is that Valley counties are indeed not getting their fair share of realignment money.
Actually, I have some numbers on that. Fresno County gets $12,176 per offender, compared to Contra Costa County, gets $40,346 per offender. So quite a big difference.
Yeah, a big difference. Part of the reason is that Valley counties, being very conservative, they haven't embraced the course that Sacramento would like to see counties take. And that's not emphasizing lockup so much and spending more on mental health programs, drug rehabilitation, and the like. So as our local counties go down the path that Sacramento prefers, we're likely to see our share of dollars increase. That said, this does not explain the discrepancy between what some Bay Area counties have received and the Valley counties have received.
Isn't one of the arguments, though, that it's also a higher cost of living in the Bay Area, and therefore that's impacting what they're receiving?
Well, not to the degree of the discrepancy, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's more than three times.
You know, in Tulare County, they're having trouble spending that money. There just aren't the rehab places, the drug rehab, and the mental health resources to actually contract with people so that they can get those services.
Professor Monroe, what do you see as the biggest impact of the state capital, how it impacted the region this last year?
Well, yeah, I think interestingly enough, the big impact is what happened everywhere but the North Valley, and the way that that's going to interface with the North Valley representatives. And that is, you know, North Valley, San Joaquin County, Stanislaus County, Merced County has sort of historically had pretty moderate representatives in the legislature on both sides of the aisle, and they continue to elect those sorts of representatives in this last cycle. But what you're seeing now and what you saw statewide is the sort of institutional – the implementation of the top two primary system along with the new sort of districts that are drawn by the Independent Redistricting Commission has created a sort of class of more moderate legislators coming from other parts of the state. And so what you might see as a result of this is a little bit bigger coalition and a little broader geographic coalition of moderates that sort of are likely to team up with the sort of, you know, I think prototypical Valley, you know, North Valley Republicans and Democrats to try to sort of bring more moderate policy that I think is favored by those North Valley constituents.
Are we going to see the reemergence of the Valleycrat?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a theme that showed up a lot in the in this last.
And you might
election.
Want to define what a Valleycrat is.
Well, I think in simple terms, it's. That it's somebody that is, regardless of being a Republican or a Democrat, is often moderate and first and foremost sort of for the Valley, for the person, you know, puts out front issues that are sort of, you know, near and dear to the constituents of the Valley and you know, water issues, you know, employment issues, things that, you know, that really center on the kinds of problems that show up a lot in the Valley.
Well, Professor Murrah, let's talk about the November election. What were the biggest takeaways for both the state and federal races that impacted the Valley, that were occurring in the Valley?
Well, you know, let me go in a little different direction and suggest that maybe the big takeaway, and this has implications for the whole state, is that, you know, quietly the term limits ballot initiative passed. And one of the things that I think that
could you explain what that is?
Well, so we have we've been operating under a previous term limit law in which members of the Assembly could only serve for 3 2-year terms and members of the Senate could only serve for 2 4-year terms. And so
let's do the math on that. So right. 6 and 8 years.
6 and 8 years. So a total of 14 years. But what happens is you only get 6 years in the Assembly, 8 in the Senate. And so you get members hopping back and forth between the chambers, and you get some members that, you know, serve their 6 years, say, in the Assembly and then fail to get elected in the Senate. And so the overall pool of expertise in any given chamber is relatively small. This change will allow it shortens the total amount of time from 14 years to 12, but it allows that amount of time to be served in either chamber. And so what you're going to see is sort of a middle ground between those that are concerned about, you know, members becoming entrenched and disconnected from their constituents and those that think that term limits sort of take away much-needed expertise in the chambers. And that, combined with some of this sort of these reforms that allow moderates to be elected, could have a significant change for the whole state and certainly for the Valley.
Well, Bill, what do you see as the biggest takeaway from the elections for the San Joaquin Valley?
Well, first of all, we have Henry T. Perea, the Assembly member, and he's a rising star in the Democratic Party. I think he's accumulating enough influence that he can get the governor to look at Valley issues. And traditionally, Governor Brown hasn't shown much interest in Valley issues. So that will be very interesting. The other thing is with Michael Rubio in the state Senate, he's received a prestigious appointment, very important appointment, in that he heads the Senate Environmental Committee. And Governor Brown, one of his priorities is, what do you want to call it, modifying or reforming the California Environmental Quality Act.
CEQA.
So Senator Michael Rubio will be a powerful voice in that. Very quickly, I want to make this one observation. For all the talk about how reform has come and maybe we'll have more moderate candidates, when Assembly Speaker John Perez made his committee appointments, you can make a case that he did so solely on the ability of those people to raise money, because 10 of the biggest fundraisers in the Assembly are the people that got these prestigious appointments. So it looks like we're talking about reform and we want consideration of serious issues. It looks like money makes the world go round, and the Democratic Party, which now has control of Sacramento, all locked up, they're basing the responsibilities that they give to elected officials on their ability to raise money for the Democratic Party.
Well, let's also
it's
talk
a very serious concern.
Let's also talk about the federal races. You know, we have a new congressman in the South Valley, David Valdeo. Republicans obviously are in control of the House. We've got a third-ranking member also from the Valley, Kevin McCarthy. So at the state level, the Democrats have some sway, people like Henry Perea, Assemblymember. But at the federal level, we've got some Republicans also that have some sway. Wouldn't you say that?
Well, they're in powerful positions, but Washington, D.C. is in a state of gridlock. So how much power do they really wield? Kevin McCarthy made it very clear, I mean, one or two days after the election, saying we need to say no to high-speed rail. So we see what one of his priorities is, and David Valadao was elected on a no to high-speed rail platform as well. So whether they're whistling in the wind or wield real power, I don't know. I do know this. President Obama is committed to high-speed rail, and he has the power with the executive authority to get a lot of this done.
Forgot David Devin Nunes, Bill, from Tulare County, congressman, who coined the term the train to nowhere. Those are three powerful Republicans. Devin is the head of is on the Ways and Means Committee and is gaining leadership in the House. So those are three powerful Republicans regarding high-speed rail. They could throw a boulder in front of the train here. As far as the other races go, besides David Valadao and Rudy Salas in Kearns County, there wasn't much change in the either the legislative or the congressional delegation in the South San Joaquin Valley. What is going to be a challenge is how those very conservative, mostly ag-oriented representatives deal with now a new democratically controlled legislature, especially on issues such as water, CEQA, environmental issues, business development, and some reforms, tax reform.
Right. Well, First Monroe, what about going forward here? What should we be keeping an eye on in Sacramento?
Well, I think he just hit on it. Tax reform is going to be the one that I think in the next year is going to be fascinating to watch, right? As the Democrats, you know, there's some complicated sort of musical chairs going on with whether or not, you know, when and if there's going to be any real two-thirds majority during any kind of legislative session. But certainly as the Democrats get close to and flirt with that two-thirds majority, they're going to be pressing very, very hard for tax reform because, of course, you know, that this is where the budget has now moved back to a simple majority. Tax reform is the sort of lone main policy area where two-thirds is required. And so if they can either get that two-thirds with of Democrats and then try to hold the party line, or if they, get within one or two seats and can entice just one or two.
Couldn't it also go another way? It could have the moderate Democrats work with a group of Republicans to also pass tax reform.
Yeah, it could, although I think, you know, what you really ultimately to wrestle away good agenda setting authority from the leadership in the Democratic Party to even get those things all the way through the either chamber is going to be a feat even for a coalition, I think, of Republicans and moderate Democrats. So, you know, they may block it, but they're going to have a tough time pushing their own reforms.
Paul, is there anything that you're hoping for or dreading coming out of Sacramento in 2013?
Well, I think some reform of the Proposition 13 requirements, I would be hoping for, and the.
But you're not talking specifically about residential property. You're talking about commercial property or the two-thirds vote for local taxes, those kinds of things.
Number of things, yeah, not necessarily the rolling back that whole provision about.
I don't think anybody wants to go there.
No, nobody. That's that. I think you mentioned in the previous part of the program, it's the third rail of politics, and nobody's going to touch it in California. Yeah. But the other thing is CEQA, is our environmental impact. Review and streamlining a lot of those regulations. I mean, that can be a very attractive platform, but for both Republicans and Democrats, if you put it in terms of, hey, this is a business generating initiative here.
And I think the unions want to show the Democratic Party. Maybe people refer to them the same way, but they want to show that they're business friendly. And this would be one way to do that, to kind of be pro CEQA reform. And Senator Rubio is in a great position to really take some action on that.
There's a lot there for Democrats to appeal to their constituents on this too. I mean, they could really be very appealing to the voters in their districts if they can come through with good practical reform on environmental laws.
Bill, what are you seeing coming out of Sacramento in 2013?
One thing I really want to address is the fact that Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee, longtime observer of California politics, he has for many years now put forward the theory that California is ungovernable. With this election and the Democrats in total control, California now is governable. There should not be gridlock on anything. The question is, now that California is governable again, is it going to be good government or bad government? My final observation on this is the water bond likely to go on the ballot. And this
do you think that's going to happen, or do you think they're going to renegotiate that?
It depends on whether we get rain or not this year. If we do get rain, people have no interest in voting for dams and infrastructure. If we don't get rain and people's water is rationed, all of a sudden they become very interested in water and how it's moved about the state of California. And if we have a very dry year, the farmers will be hurting, but it could end up on the ballot and it could get passed if we go through more dry spell.
Okay, well, when we come back, we'll talk about where the political winds might be blowing in Sacramento in 2013 and how it might impact the San Joaquin Valley. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're talking about state politics in 2012, the year that was, as well as what to expect this year with Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times-Delta, Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, and Professor Nathan Monroe with the UC Merced. So what about the Republican Party? They're now below 30% registered voters in California. What's it going to take to make them relevant in California politics, Bill?
Well, I don't see that they have a big role to play in lawmaking in Sacramento. They have played the role of the loyal opposition the last decade or so and the ability to block Democratic initiatives. I think their role for 2013 is they have to hunker down and decide what the Republican brand in California is going to be. And I think they have to rebuild the party. As you know, Mark, their party apparatus and structure is almost in complete disarray at this point. Don't have a lot of money in the bank, so they have big challenges. And I think that people in the Republican Party have to get together and build a consensus on what they want the brand to be here. A lot of people are saying that California Republicans have to be more moderate. They have to talk a lot less about social issues or what we used to call hot button issues, and that they have to sell their ideas on what brings prosperity and how you elevate people in society, how you give people the tools to success. The challenge here in California is much the same as it is elsewhere across the nation when your most active party members are far to the right. How do you get this brand that's going to be more pleasing? And if you alienate the Tea Party, will there be any version of the Republican Party left?
Well, there's a question of whether the Tea Party is fiscally conservative or socially conservative. I think some of the Tea Party folks would say they're really focusing on fiscal conservatism. But Paul, you know, let's talk about strategy and tactics versus message. I mean, is it one or the other? Is it both?
Oh, it's both. And I think I've mentioned this elsewhere. Justin Stoner, who's a aide to Assemblywoman Connie Conway, wrote up
the Republican minority leader.
Republican minority leader it wrote a very astute column in the Times-Delta, noting that what the Republicans have to do is appeal to more people. They can't be just talking only to white males, people of wealth, and people of power. They need to branch out and appeal to the new minorities, women, and people who are usually not part of their constituency. There would be an excellent way to do that if they would just focus on one issue, on one a core thing that they would pursue in California, and that would be education. If they could just focus on education reform, on improving our education structure, on bringing California back to the way it was in public education, They appeal to all those groups.
Is this a way
it offers them opportunity?
Is this a way to kind of create a wedge between the voters and the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party is so attached to the teachers' unions?
I don't know about a wedge, but I think everybody would agree that the system needs some reform and that making it more open and appeal and having the Republicans become the party of education, not necessarily teachers' unions, but the party of education would be a way to recover some of that.
Professor Monroe, what do you see in terms of the Republican Party and their viability in California going forward?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's they're bound to resurge. I doubt we're going to see a long stagnant period for Republicans.
Are you predicting overreach by the Democrats?
I think that there'll be inevitably some overreach by the Democrats. I think it's just part of how the system works and part of the way that you hand them the sort of keys to the kingdom and they're gonna do with it. You cite this sort of statistic that less than 30% of registered voters are Republicans. But that's not what you have to notice is that that's being sucked up by decline to states, right?
Right.
It's not as though Democrats are surging in registration. It's that the sort of undeclared middle is expanding.
But they're breaking for the Democrats.
They are breaking for the Democrats, but that's a very different class of voter than a sort of loyalist Democrat who is going to sort of be a steadfast, permanent, supporter of the Democratic agenda. And so, I mean, I do think, that said, I don't think that means that the Republicans can just do anything or just hang tight and come back. I think that they, certainly have, I think that suggestion is a very good one. I think picking an issue, and education is a very good one, mm-hmm. to make their issue and to move away from some of their traditional issues that are very polarizing. When you talk about the Tea Party, in some sense, it doesn't matter whether they're socially or economically conservative, fiscally conservative. They need to distance themselves from that label because it's a label that is associated nationally with a very extremist component of the Republican Party that just doesn't play very well with those moderate voters.
Well, it does seem to play in the Valley. I mean, Valley is one of the strongholds of the Republican Party in California. Will the Republicans' lessen political clout in Sacramento have any impact for the Valley? I mean, are the Valley legislators going to be somewhat isolated and unable to get things done for their region because they don't even have a third of the legislature?
Well, I think that depends on which Republicans you're talking about. I mean, there are some moderate, when you look at Anthony Cannella, who's up in my neck of the woods, and he's a real moderate Republican who I think is very likely to sort of play ball with the Democratic Party on certain issues and, is going to be willing to sort of compromise, and some of that is going to allow him to make, sort of the deals that happen in Sacramento to deliver particular things for his area of the Valley. And, of course, he's not going to be operating in isolation, right? I mean, he sort of overlaps with a new sort of Valleycrat, Adam Gray, who's in the Assembly side. And, their politics are, so far overlapping that there's going to be a lot of things that
and
are going to be delivered.
And a Michael Rubio down south
there
in Bakersfield.
There's going to be a lot of overlap, I think, in what some of those moderate Republicans want to do and their ability to get those things done.
Well, Bill, let's talk about the Democrats and their supermajorities. They also have the governorship. Is this a situation where the Democrats are damned if they do and damned if they don't? If they go too far, voters are going to say, hey, stop, overreach, and they'll vote against them. If they don't take any action, voters are going to say, well, why do we elect you? You're not doing anything.
Well, the safeguard here is you have Governor Jerry Brown, whose politics are considerably more conservative than the people that are on the far left. And when you compare Governor Brown's politics to lawmakers from the Bay Area or parts of Southern California, he's the conservative on this. And I think that Governor Brown's very concerned about his legacy. He's also concerned about the fact that he said, we'll never raise taxes unless the people vote on this. And so he's already made it clear, and he's signaled to Senate Leader Steinberg and to Perez that we have to be adults and we have to have moderation. And he's also signaled that when you're looking at the budget forecast that came out of the nonpartisan legislative analyst office saying there are going to be budget surpluses in the future with the passage of Proposition 30 and the turn in the economy. And Governor Brown's made it very clear, focusing on infrastructure and education and those kinds of things. So I think if the Democrats overreach, they're going to face the veto pen.
Yeah, there were a lot of ifs on the LAO's report. You know, if we see steady growth, if we don't implement a rainy day fund, if the unions, which are, by the way, most of their contracts are up this summer, don't ask for wage increases or get a cost of living adjustment. There's a lot of ifs in the LAO's report. So whether we see those surpluses going forward is questionable. Well, Professor Monroe, what do you think? Do you think that the Democrats are going to be this monolithic two-thirds majority marching through the legislature, or they're going to start to be some splintering off and maybe some moderates like Senator Rubio from Bakersfield, a Democrat, or Senator Kinella, a Republican up north, or maybe we'll get together on some issues?
Yeah, I think I don't think that – I think it's going to be a little bit of both. I mean, there are going to be times when the Democrats are going to be able to be heavy-handed on a certain set of – you know, on some issues and really force them through, right? I mean, you know, at this point, on all the issues that they don't need two-thirds on, right, they've got plenty of cushion, right? So they can push forward more mainstream Democratic agenda items in the form that they want and probably force them through. That said, I think you are going to see some splintering. You're going to see some moderates moving away from the Democratic leadership on issues.
So we've only got a short time left. I just want to get through very fast, maybe 15 seconds for each, and that is, what are we going to see overall with the legislature in 2013? More cooperative, more combative? What? Professor Monroe, what do you think?
I think you're going to see a generally more cooperative legislature with some noted exceptions.
Bill?
Well, the Democrats, this is their chance to shine. They've said that they have the message, the platform, the plans to move California forward, and it's no excuse time. They're running the show, and if California doesn't move forward, shame on the Democrats.
Paul?
I think we're going to see just as much contention as ever, and it's probably going to be among Democrats as well as from Republicans. Republicans haven't got much choice except to make a lot of noise, and they'll make it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I want to thank Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, and Professor Nathan Monroe from UC Merced for joining us. If you want to stay up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, just by logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.